You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
Viral, the search for the origin of COVID-19 by Dr. Alina Chan and one of my all-time favorite writers and a friend of this podcast, Matt Ridley, talking to Dr. Alina Chan right now. Alina, thank you so much for writing this book. This is like the definitive book on where COVID came from and all the research that's gone on since forever.
Thank you for the high praise.
It's really great. And I was amazed even in the very beginning. So let me get this straight. So 2012, a bunch of miners who were in a mine that was filled with bats, I guess they were mining guano, the bat shit or whatever, they all got infected with a COVID-like illness that turns out to be about 90, almost 99% match for the current COVID genome sequence?
Well, not exactly. It's still a mystery, actually. But what we know is that there were six men who went into that mine to excavate and to clear it out. And they were just exposed to a huge amount of fecal matter from the bats. Like, it stunk, and then they were shoveling it by the heaps out of the cave. And they sickened with this mysterious pneumonia, and they even invited the top SARS expert in China, Zhong Nanshan, to evaluate the cases. And he said, go to that cave, collect the bats, like sample them for the viruses, check if it's SARS, and check the patients for SARS. And we know that when the samples were sent off, the WIV, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, was the one to perform the test. And they said that these miners had antibodies for SARS virus. So they didn't seem to be able to isolate the virus that infected these miners, but the medical thesis describing these cases concludes that these miners most likely were infected by a SARS-like virus. And so we know that over the years following that, multiple groups of researchers in China went to that mine to find the virus that had caused this disease. And the most important one that they found was a 96% match to the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the one that causes COVID-19. So from there, there's been a lot of speculation on whether the researchers visiting that mine might have found something even closer to SARS-CoV-2 and brought it back to a lab to study.
I see. So the miners, though, from in 2012, they had a SARS-1-like virus, or we don't really know for sure?
We don't know for sure.
They might have had the one that was found that's the 96% match, because the symptoms are relatively similar. And they had, some of them died. They had an extreme version of what we call COVID-2 now.
So what we know from the medical thesis that described the cases is that they had not transmitted the disease to anyone else, including the healthcare workers and the miners. They had been actually in their hometowns, just walking around, going to the local clinic. It was at least 2 weeks before they were admitted to the hospital in the capital of the province, so like Kunming in the province of Yunnan. And by the time they called in this expert, Zhong Nanshan, it was already more than a month they had been hospitalized. And by the time they sent samples to the WIV, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, it was likely too late to get any sequence of the virus that infected them because they'd been sick for so long and the virus would have been cleared out by then. So whatever they were suffering from was the secondary infections and a completely destroyed body.
The fact that they weren't able to transmit it to other people, it could be the case that this variant of whatever SARS it was just required so much exposure to bat guano that unless you were just spreading somebody with bat guano, they're not going to get it.
Yes. So what happened to them was probably a very massive exposure to bad coronaviruses. So there's a principle here is that when there's an animal pathogen, so let's say a coronavirus that has lived for, you know, spread for years in bats, it doesn't mean that it can transfer to humans very easily. It doesn't mean it can spill over into humans very easily. So on rare circumstances, some of these bat viruses can jump into humans, but even after it's jumped into humans, it needs to adapt to the new host, the new animal. So it takes a while before that virus will become easily transmissible between human beings and infectious to human beings.
So it's interesting because I would say there's almost like three, perhaps four parts to your book. One is kind of this history of SARS, then MERS, then SARS-CoV-2, you know, and you kind of go into, you know, what happened with SARS 20 years ago and even before that, it was very interesting how you described the flu, the flu epidemic in 1919. And then part two is more like what happened in November of 2019 through, let's say, March of 2020 when the pandemic, we were first starting to realize there was a pandemic happening. And then it's kind of what's happened since then in terms of how we've discovered new things about this virus and vaccine and so on. So in this first part, well, I want to get back to this 2012 bat situation, but your story about how the flu pandemic in 1919 was so deadly and violent and how it spread was very interesting. I didn't know that either. I didn't know that it basically came from, let's say, returning soldiers in World War I, which you mentioned. Can you describe that pandemic and why it was so deadly?
Well, this flu pandemic that happened 100 years ago, I think we need to clarify that the technologies 100 years ago versus the technologies today are extremely different. And thank goodness for that. So like today, we can sequence the genome of an entirely novel virus that we've never seen before in like 2 to 3 days. You can take a sample from a patient, send it through next-gen sequencing, and you get the genome out in 2 to 3 days. And today, we have like 4 million high-quality SARS-CoV-2 genomes. So you can actually watch a virus in real time evolving, getting better, adapting to humans. But we had zero of those technologies back 100 years ago, or even for like things like HIV or whatever. Like, there's no way we can watch the virus evolving as it spreads from person to person in the first months of its emergence. So the flu from 100 years ago, that pandemic, the records are pretty sparse. And from what you can put together, it spread around the world, mostly because of other deployment of troops. But it was nothing compared to what we have today, where we can fly from one city to another city in like less than a day. And there's so many people traveling, right? So I'd say that today we're actually much more primed for a pandemic to run rampant than it was 100 years ago.
But what made that one so deadly?
So influenza virus is different from coronavirus. And the transmissibility of a virus, its ability to spread from person to person, doesn't matter on how severe the disease it causes. So they're quite kind of separate characteristics for a virus. So we cannot compare influenza viruses directly to coronavirus. They're just different. And even amongst coronaviruses, there's different levels of severity of disease they cause. So there are 4 common cold coronaviruses, but the 3 coronaviruses of concern, they are SARS-1, MERS, and SARS-2. So for example, MERS can kill up to a third of the human beings it infects, but it doesn't transmit well between human to human.
It seems like there's a reverse correlation between the mortality rate, like how many people it kills, versus transmissibility. Because as you mentioned in the book, the more fatal it is, people are going to die. They're not going to transmit it. They're going to be so sick. They're not out and going to parties and super spreader events. They're dying. So it doesn't transmit. So and that seems common, like the math of viruses, whether it's the flu or COVID, seems somewhat similar. So I'm just curious why that particular flu was so deadly and so transmissible. Like, what was unusual about it?
I don't think there's anything particularly unusual about the flu pandemic. I mean, some of the flu viruses today are actually quite deadly to humans, but they don't transmit well. So thinking about the gain of function debate, it was really, it peaked in 2011 when there were scientists in different countries trying to make a bird flu virus more transmissible between mammals through the air. So this already had a kill rate of something like 60%. So it could kill more than half of the humans it infected. But they wanted to see whether they could make it airborne, whether they can make this virus spread through the air between mammals. So it's not unusual for an influenza virus to be deadly.
So again, like, what separates out that 1919 pandemic from, let's say, the flu right now?
Maybe it helps to zoom out a bit to the picture of all the viruses in nature. So they're just millions, like billions of viruses in nature. Not all of them are animal viruses. Not all of them can infect animals or mammals or even humans. Actually, a very small fraction of viruses can infect humans. So it's not possible to look at, even within a family, to look at all viruses, to look at one and say, why is it so different than another virus in the same family? Because there's so much diversity. So if you ask virus collectors, for example, or virologists, like, they would tell you that we know only such a small fraction of the viruses that exist in this world. So it's really difficult to look at one influenza virus and look at another influenza virus and say, why did this one cause a pandemic versus the other one?
Right, but like this again was very transmissible, and and it did it delay killing people? Like, people had it for a while, so they had an opportunity to spread it? I'm just trying to build a general understanding of, like, looking at what a deadly pandemic actually is. Like, that was the deadliest one that we've had in hundreds of years. Let's, maybe the Black Plague which was a bacterial thing was worse. But as far as I know, this was the deadliest virus ever in 100 years ago. Like, was it that it did not kill people so quickly, so they had a chance to transmit it before displaying symptoms? I'm just trying to understand, like, what the worst pandemic looks like.
I guess if you're thinking about what the worst pandemic pathogen would look like, it would be one that looks quite like SARS-CoV-2, but maybe more deadly. So, for example, SARS-CoV-2, the virus can spread before someone shows symptoms. So if you have a virus like that, how could you possibly stop it from spreading? Because you don't know who is a carrier, unless you're testing everyone, like, every day. So that's one trick it has up its sleeve. Other things. So clearly having a long infection time during which a person is infectious is important. Something that can spread by air, like SARS-CoV-2 and SARS-1 and influenza. You could have someone just working in a room for an hour and he leaves the room or she leaves the room, and then another person comes in and breathes the air and can get infected. So it doesn't require close contact or even touching anything. It's just the air. So that's another thing that makes this virus so good at being a pandemic virus. Other things, it probably has to do with the deadliness too. So this virus is not so deadly like Ebola, for example, that people are so scared that they take extra strong precautions. So this virus, SARS-CoV-2, it has such a low fatality rate that a lot of people are willing to take the risk. They're like, I'm not going to be the 1% that dies. And they're like, they would rather have a functional society and economy than to have everyone protected. But if you had something that was, you know, like even 10% kill rate, then I suspect people would take very strong measures to stop the spread of that virus.
I remember when the news was first hitting, it was the theory was that SARS-CoV-2 had a 2% fatality rate. What ended up being the case fatality rate?
I think it's quite close to that. So 1 or 2%. It depends on the environment and the available healthcare resources. So if you're in a country and a city where there's top of the line, like antibodies you can be injected with, or like, you know, your ventilators, that kind of thing, and the top doctors in the world, that you stand a much better chance, right, than someone who doesn't even have, like, access to oxygen.
And what makes something a case? Like, if somebody's completely asymptomatic and we don't even know they have it, is that considered a case?
Yes. Okay. As long as you've been infected by the virus, you are a COVID-19 patient.
Because then we don't really know how many people have had COVID. Because many, we don't know, like, what percentage do you think are asymptomatic?
Well, not just asymptomatic, but this virus causes so many different symptoms that you could even just have diarrhea and you wouldn't know that you have COVID-19 because it just infected your gut instead of your lungs. So there's probably a massive undercount of the number of people who've been infected with COVID-19 already.
So that could mean the case fatality rate is much lower just because we don't know how many cases there are.
Well, that's also an issue of whether all of the deaths have been counted. So I think in some countries where it's not possible to test post-mortem, that could be a massive undercount.
Okay, so all these stuff I want to get back to, but starting with the Bat Cave in 2012, apparently now, as you mentioned in the book, apparently now if you try to visit that cave, it's like fully surrounded by military, you're told to go away. Like, why did the Chinese government decide, okay, nobody is ever going to go to this cave again?
I don't know. I'm not the Chinese government, so I don't know why they would block people from entering that cave. But that cave was the source of the closest relatives to SARS-CoV-2 when it emerged. So there were a lot of scientists who wanted to go there to sample and see whether they could find something even closer to SARS-CoV-2.
But nobody's ever had access to it. Like, they weren't able to do that.
I'm not sure. I think some select groups of Chinese researchers may have been allowed to go there, but we don't know. And we just know that anyone who hasn't been permitted, given permission to go there, they've been obstructed in almost every way possible, like threatened, they had their things confiscated. There was one pretty hilarious story of a Wall Street Journal journalist who rode a mountain bike through the dense like jungle to try and get to the cave. He managed to get there, snap a photo of it, but the police got him and they made him delete the photo.
Wow. So, okay, so starting from that, like, assume this is like a direct ancestor, a distant ancestor of the COVID we all know and love right now. What happened between 2012 and 2019? Like, what made it a kind of a much more human friendly virus?
So I just want to clarify that the virus RATG13, the closest relative at the time, the 96% match, I don't think that was the ancestor of SARS-CoV-2. So it would require some very extreme methods to transform it to SARS-CoV-2. I've heard people even describe it as molecularly impossible. So I think that if SARS-CoV-2 had come from a lab, then its direct precursor must have been a different virus that was found and brought to that lab. So there's likely something much, much closer to SARS-CoV-2. We just don't know whether it was collected by a lab or whether it infected an animal in the wildlife trade and was brought to Wuhan.
Yeah, so what do you think?
So we, in our book, in the book of Matt Ridley, we don't try to force our opinions on the readers. We try to lay out everything as objectively as possible. And at the end of the book, we steelman both hypotheses. So we argue first as strongly as we can for a natural origin. And I know that people can't believe that because Matt and I have traditionally had more of a lab-leaning approach, but we really did task ourselves with setting up the strongest case possible for a natural origin of the virus. And then after that, we do the same for a lab origin. So we put forward the strongest case we can. And at the end of the book, we mentioned some of the latest developments on the story, more documents released showing the type of risky pathogen research that was ongoing in Wuhan right before the pandemic. So I'd say that we do lean towards a lab origin, but we don't force this point of view on our readers.
And it seems like, I mean, there's totally natural origin. And as you said, there's lab origin, but within the lab origin context, there's kind of natural origin that's being studied in a lab that's accidentally leaked. And then there's kind of maybe a slightly more malicious creation, like maybe a virus that had natural origin that was tweaked in a lab and then leaked or spread or whatever. But it seems from your book and from all the different stories over the past 2 years, it seems like natural origin gets into a lab, it's being studied and maybe accidentally leaked. It's probably, that's almost like the Occam's razor. Like that almost seems like the simplest solution. So like, let's say that is what happened, what would have happened? So they find this virus. How would the lab, and it ends up in a lab, how would the lab people know that this is a potential human-to-human virus? They probably the virus probably started with bats, and as you mentioned, pangolin, and then ends up in a lab. Like, how does it end up in the lab?
So the latest leaked and Freedom of Information Act documents show that in the years leading up to 2019, not just China, but actually 7 countries surrounding China in Southeast Asia were sending samples of animals likely to be infected with SARS-like viruses up to Wuhan. So Wuhan was getting thousands of these animal samples from the wildlife trade across 8 countries in total being sent up into that city for analysis. And so what the scientists there were trying to do was to examine these novel SARS-like viruses and see which ones were likely to spill over to infect humans, to jump from an animal in the wildlife trade into humans. And the ways that they would, the methods they used to evaluate this was to first sequence the virus, so understand what its blueprint is, and then try to grow it in the lab. So using a variety of different cell types to see which cells, human, bat, you know, like pig, primate, would enable this virus to grow. And then once you have the virus, try to infect different cells with it, different human cells, so even human lung cells, to see whether this virus can cause disease in human lungs. And after that, move into animal models. So animals like civet cats, which were the intermediate host of SARS-1, they had bats in the lab as well, and they had humanized mice. So mice that had human genes that would enable SARS-like virus infection. So they were using these to see how likely is it that this novel virus I've just been sent from, let's say, Laos in Southeast Asia is likely to jump from an animal infected in the wildlife trade into a human that's handling that animal.
So what do you think happened? So that they got all these viruses, and then one of them, which is essentially COVID, did turn out to be not only a human-to-human type of virus, but one with extreme transmissibility because symptoms wouldn't exhibit for 10 days potentially. So this was like, again, the perfect storm of viruses.
Yeah.
Is that just kind of by chance they found this because they got thousands of potential viruses and one out of those thousand happened to be the perfect storm of viruses? Or do you think they tweaked it a little bit? Or what's kind of the range of stories right now?
I think these are all options on the table. So It's possible that maybe even a researcher who was on a sampling trip, so a field work trip, they went to a market, they were sampling sick animals. Hunting for viruses. So they're sampling tens of thousands of bats, wild animals in markets, and even sick people. So they were particularly looking for thousands of people who worked in the wildlife trade who were exposed to these animals, and they were taking samples from them, blood samples, stool samples, and spit samples. So you could get infected during that process by one of these tens of thousands of animals or people. So that's one way for a person to have been infected and brought the virus to Wuhan. The next step up is where you have taken the sample back to the lab and you're growing it up. So this virus would look completely natural because you've taken it from nature. But because you've grown it up, you're doing things with it, you get infected in the lab, especially because it's airborne. So they were working at a low biosafety level, BSL-2, in that lab. So it doesn't protect you against airborne viruses at all. It's not surprising that if there was a spill or something, you would have been infected. Another step above that is where you are actually tweaking the virus, so putting new features into the virus. And we have seen leaked documents that show that they had a roadmap for doing such a thing starting in early 2018. So if you do that, you could potentially create a virus with unpredictable characteristics, something that might look like SARS-CoV-2.
And so other than doing that to weaponize it, what other reasons, what other reasons might someone tweak a virus?
So I have to say that quite clearly, first, that I don't think that SARS-CoV-2 was developed as a bioweapon. Looking at its code, I don't think anyone would have designed the bioweapon this way. And honestly, looking at all the published literature and even the leaked documents, these experiments, they were not aimed at building weapons. They were aimed at just understanding biology of viruses. So were they potentially too negligent on biosafety? I'd say you can argue that. But I don't think that they were weaponizing viruses.
Yeah, I believe that. I was just curious what other reasons, but you just explained because they were trying to understand the biology of these viruses and so on. Could there ever be like, this is a naive question, but could there ever be a good use of a virus? Like, oh, we know this virus transmits from person to person, so we can spread a virus that changes the cells in a good way instead of a bad way.
Oh yeah, there's lots of viruses being used for good purposes. So actually, a lot of gene therapy relies on viruses. For example, the most well-known one today is AAVs, which I actually work on. Adeno-associated viruses. So these viruses don't cause disease in humans. they are used precisely because they don't cause disease in humans. And so you can put therapeutic genes. So you've taken out the virus's actual genome and you're putting in genes that can heal a person, help them recover from disease. And you use this virus to deliver like medicine to people. So viruses can be repurposed. So not only the virus can be repurposed, but even genes inside the virus, even genes from some of the most dangerous viruses we know, like HIV, Ebola, they can be used to do good things. So even the diagnostics for COVID-19, you know, everyone's hearing about this like PCR, like RT-PCR, that test uses a gene from a virus. So there are lots of parts from viruses we can use to do like massive good for humanity.
Are there any viruses right now that actually are being spread through humanity that cure other viruses?
That cure other viruses? You mean dangerous pathogens?
No. Like you just mentioned, you can have these positive sort of viruses that cure people.
Yeah.
Is that being done right now?
Yes. So AAVs, adeno-associated viruses, actually, most of us have been exposed to some of these at some point, but we don't really know because they don't cause disease. And now they're being harnessed for gene therapy.
But what do they cure us of? Like, why do we spread them around?
So they're not spread around because they cure us of anything. It's just it just exists in nature. It's co-evolved with humans and other animals as it's infected us. And so it's not something that we deliberately get or benefits us in some way. It's just out there infecting us. But humans have been able to repurpose this virus and use it for therapy.
Right. And so what therapy has it done that successfully? Like when you say therapy, I'm assuming it spread and whoever gets this virus is cured of something. Well, what have we been cured of by one of these viruses?
So I think I need to clarify a bit. So it's not that the natural virus is curing the disease. So again, like when we take that virus, we remove its genome. So we take out all of the genetic code that's in there that makes more of itself, and we put in genes that will help people be cured of their diseases. And the diseases that we target tend to be genetic diseases, like rare genetic diseases, things where a single mutation causes a rare disease in humans. And so we put the natural gene for humans back into that virus and we send it into the body. So this is not something where we get a virus from a human being and put it in unchanged into another human being.
But like, okay, but this exists? Like what rare genetic diseases are being cured by this?
So one of the most prominent ones is SMA, spinal muscular atrophy. Mm-hmm. So it's a neurodegenerative disease. And luckily, you can put that gene, a replacement gene, into a AAV and use it to cure patients. But you tend to have to deliver it very young. So when they're infants, basically. Because once you're an adult, it's really difficult to treat it.
Can there ever be like, again, totally stupid question, and it's a sidetrack from what we're talking about. Can there ever be like an anti-COVID virus so that it spreads and it stops COVID?
I think this idea you're talking about has been toyed with by some virologists even, or some vaccine developers, is they're talking about an attenuated form of virus. And actually, it has been used before. So, but it's kind of uncontrollable sometimes. So even polio, there was a polio vaccine that actually was a weakened form of polio that they were giving children so that when it encountered the real dangerous form of polio, you would have already developed immunity against the weaker form of polio. But what they found is that over the years, as people were getting this attenuated version, it actually gained in function. It evolved around the mutation it had to actually become transmissible between humans and causing severe disease. So that vaccine has been completely taken out of use. So don't worry about it. There's no like dangerous polio vaccine out there. It's been eliminated. And so now most of the vaccines we use today are very controlled. So they don't use these live attenuated viruses. They use mRNA. So where they just send in a single gene. So a single piece of genetic code that encodes one part of the virus, but not the whole virus. Or they send in a single protein from the virus, so they don't give you a whole live virus anymore.
So I want to talk about vaccines in a little bit, but I'll start off now. If they only have like one protein, Mm-hmm. Will that help people with all the different variants that are kind of popping up?
So mostly, yes. So the question is really to what extent? So yes, if you get the mRNA vaccines or the protein vaccines, you will develop an immune response to that protein. And so when you encounter the actual SARS-CoV-2, even if it's a variant, your body should still recognize it. Your immune system should still recognize it and take it down. But as the virus evolves and becomes more different, then that effect is diminished slightly. So that's why there are now discussions about boosters or maybe making boosters that correspond to the variants, the new variants, rather than the original SARS-CoV-2.
Are people going to need like booster shots every 6 months or every year? Kind of like the flu shot?
Yeah, I suspect that's what's going to happen. So this virus is basically here with us forever. So it's no longer possible to eradicate. And it's so stealthy. So that's the issue, right? It's not like smallpox where if you know when you have it. You know when you have smallpox. So like, but with COVID-19, again, a lot of people can have it and they don't even know. So we will likely have to keep getting regular vaccines.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period. And I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away. And I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
November 2019, the first person comes down with actual COVID. It was somebody who had some exposure to the Wuhan laboratory, but surprisingly, as you point out, they weren't exposed to the wet markets that were near the laboratory. It seemed like the first couple of cases didn't have anything to do with the wet markets as originally thought. But like, what happened? How did this spread happen from there?
It's really challenging that even up to today, almost 2 years post-outbreak, we have so little information on the earliest cases of COVID-19. So we don't know who they were. We don't know their occupations. We don't know if they were exposed to people working in the lab. We've basically been stonewalled. So we cannot.
But we know they were in Wuhan, though.
Yeah, we do know that they were in Wuhan. But we don't know like where they got this infection from. If the Chinese authorities did any contact tracing, we don't know. So it's not like there's a published survey of who their family members were, you know, who their co-workers were, and who they might have got COVID-19 from. So right now, we pretty much have no insight as to where the first cases might have caught the virus.
Other than they seem to have happened around the same time, like in November 2019, December 2019, and they seem to happen in Wuhan, and all of the kind of initial cases in Italy, Iran, the U.S., all seem to have had some contact with Wuhan. Someone would fly from Wuhan to Italy, and then suddenly the COVID would appear in Italy. So we kind of know roughly Wuhan's the source.
Yes, I think it's indisputable at this point that all of the known COVID-19 cases to date have at one point or another originated from the outbreak in Wuhan.
And then what about the like countries like Taiwan, where they kind of saw what was happening really early on, and they put on severe travel bans instantly. Were they able to protect themselves with those travel bans?
Yeah, they did. So some countries like Taiwan, Singapore, South Korea, Japan, even Australia and New Zealand, they responded very quickly to this news and they were able to shut down travel. It helped that some of them were island nations, right? So you can actually block off people coming in from any... it's not like you're you know, land bordering other countries and people can just walk over. So some of them had experienced SARS-1, been impacted very severely by the first SARS outbreak. So they took this news of a novel SARS-like virus very seriously. They were like, we're not joking around now. Like this could cause like massive like destruction socially and economically in our countries. But because this virus is now everywhere, they have had no choice but to also well, they there's no way they can do a zero COVID anymore. Like, if they want to continue functioning, having travel and business, then all the doors have to open. So they also have to have widespread vaccination policies.
Right. So, I mean, in terms of the economic lockdowns that happened, like in the U.S. and all over the world, but let's say take the U.S. as an example, how much more COVID do you think, how many more lives would have been, let's say, killed if we hadn't had the economic lockdowns? I know that's a hard question.
Yeah, I don't think I can guess the number because...
Would it have been multiples more or a percentage more?
Probably a magnitude, an order of magnitude more. I mean, it's not that the virus would become more dangerous, but it's that when you overwhelm the healthcare system, then there's less resources for everybody. And we kind of have seen that in places like India. So we never want to enter that situation here in the US, right? You don't want to have a situation where people are dying in parking lots because they can't have oxygen. So I understand why a lot of people in America especially underestimated the virus when they first heard about it, because the first SARS virus didn't impact the US that badly. Like, Canada got hit. So people in Canada took it a bit more seriously. But I think sometimes Americans have this sense of invulnerability. So like, it's a new virus is always happening somewhere else, but it never really causes destruction in the US. And so... I understand why some people were so anti-lockdown that they wanted to just take it. They wanted everyone to get infected with COVID-19 immediately. But I honestly think now with all the knowledge we have now, that would have been catastrophic.
It's interesting because it hit different parts of the country at different times. Mm-hmm. So like New York City was one of the first hit places. And then maybe the South was hit like a few months later. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if you could have staggered the lockdowns, but I don't even know feasibly how that's possible.
I don't think it's possible in the US, mm-hmm. actually most countries, unless you had some sort of authoritarian control. But even then, I don't think that that's a good thing to try, to try staggering the spread of the virus. So it could get out of control rapidly.
Yeah. So and it's unpredictable. You don't know what place is going to hit next.
So we don't want to see a situation like in the movies, right? Like Contagion. Where
Oh my gosh. I saw Contagion like in March 2020.
Yeah.
That's scary to watch it in the middle of the beginning of a pandemic when we just didn't know any information. If someone's asymptomatic, is it harder for them to transmit? Because it's not like if you're asymptomatic, you're not coughing on anybody. You're not, you know, it's probably less airborne from you.
Not necessarily, because if you're asymptomatic, you might still be going to work. You might still be partying, you know, sharing food and drinks with people and having close contact with other people. Whereas if you're symptomatic and you get tested or something, you probably self-quarantine. So it depends not only just on the amount of virus a person is producing and the coughing and spitting, that kind of thing, but also on your activity. So your behavior matters in terms of transmitting it to other people.
I see. So how do these variants result? Like What is the Delta variant? What is the Lambda variant?
What is it?
Yeah, like are they generations of, you know, descendants of the original COVID, or like how did they result?
Yeah, so when you have a virus that's just jumped from a non-human animal into human beings, it needs to adapt to the new human host. So it needs to adapt to spreading amongst humans. But after that, if you keep letting this virus spread to hundreds of millions of people, maybe even a billion people, the virus will still evolve. Like, it's not that it will never evolve again. So like it will still pick up mutations that help it to get around human immunity. So let's say after a while we're all vaccinated, there will be new variants that get around some of our human immunity. They will evolve because it's survival of the fittest. So these variants are expected. Anyone would predict it. So even let's say SARS-1, it only infected about 9,000 cases. But if you had let it infect like, you know, 100 million people, then you would have seen way more variants of SARS-1. So these Delta variants, Alpha variants, they're running out of Greek letters soon, and they've proposed naming them after like constellations. They are concerning and we should be tracking them. And keeping an eye on them and developing vaccines and boosters accordingly. But there's no stopping it at this point. We will keep seeing more variants because it will keep infecting people and evolving.
And getting it, like you mentioned, you know, COVID has very unusual effects. Like it affects multiple organs. It's not just the respiratory organs. So like it's sort of random how it affects people. And what about these long COVID cases where there's like, it seems like there's permanent damage that some people have from COVID? Is that getting more prevalent, less prevalent?
Well, I mean, as more people are infected with COVID-19, then there will be more long COVID cases. So part of the cause of this virus causing such long-term damage is that one effect of a virus infection is that some of your cells get fused with each other. So they kind of lose the regular biological structure that's required, for example, in your lungs to absorb oxygen and to deliver it to other parts of your body. So even after the virus has been cleared from your body, it has left destruction behind. So a lot of the symptoms that long COVID people report is because of these changes inside their body inflicted by the virus.
Could, and I'm going to put this in the category of stupid questions again.
No.
Could stem cells be a possible solution in these cases where you inject new virgin stem cells into the body to replace the damaged cells?
I'd say that stem cell therapy is still very, very non-mature. So it's a dream of the future, right? So that you can create any organ you like and replace it in the human body, but we're very far away from that. So we've even heard cases of people getting lung transplants after COVID. So that's what you might have to do if the damage is severe enough. But for now, I don't think that stem cell therapy is on the table.
And what about immunity? So like I told you earlier, I had COVID around July. How long does that kind of immunity last, roughly? I know there's a range.
It sometimes depends on the severity of the disease. So if you had a very severe bout of COVID-19, you probably had a stronger immune response to it. So it will last longer. If you had a really mild case, there's probably less of an immune response. And so it might peter out more quickly. But it's tough to say. And that's why I think healthcare professionals and public health professionals, they try to err on the side of caution because they don't want to tell people something that turns out later not to be true.
Yeah. And then also, what's the deal? Like, I forgot which company is doing it, maybe Pfizer, but there's a pill also to help reduce the severity of COVID. What's the difference between that pill and the vaccine?
So a vaccine is usually a part of a virus or an activated virus. So a virus has been killed that is injected into your body to try and elicit a natural immune response so that when you encounter the virus, your body's immune system is already fighting it. But something like the new pill from Pfizer or other small molecule compounds, they are meant to somehow inhibit the growth of the real virus when it's already infected you. So I'd still say that it's important to be vaccinated so that you're not put in the situation where you need to have these inhibitors or small molecules injected into your body to deal with severe COVID.
And you know, now that we've been through this experience, a couple of things strike me as unusual, and you mentioned these in the book. First off, why do you think the World Health Organization, the WHO, and China weren't more forthcoming about information that could have helped every country deal with this much faster? Why would they care about protecting China in this?
So the World Health Organization is very constrained, just structurally constrained, because it's under such strong influence by its member states, especially powerful member states, so like China and the US. So in these situations where they could risk really offending China, I think they can sometimes behave too cautiously, and sometimes that can result in delayed information sharing. So I don't want to put the blame on anybody, but I do think that there are lessons to be learned. And moving forward, the structure of detecting and sharing information about novel outbreaks has to completely change. So there can no longer be this thing of going to China's door, for example, or maybe next time it's the US, and knocking on their door and saying, can we please come in and see what's happening in there? So that should no longer be the mode of operation. There should be some sort of pandemic treaty, frankly, where all the countries agree that, on day zero, someone a whole international team gets to just go in without knocking on the door, anything, just go in there and start collecting information and sampling patients.
Yeah, because you were mentioning how even in the first papers, China wasn't releasing, I guess, the genome or whatever of COVID. It was hard to get a hold of. And so that's very frustrating, because maybe tests could have been developed earlier and so on. And what about in China itself? It seems like they locked down Wuhan for 30 days and then suddenly there was never a case in Wuhan again. Like, how realistic is that? Or do we just not have the data of what's really going on in China?
We don't have data about what's happening in China. And they locked down Wuhan for much longer than that, like 2.5 months. Like, some people were scraping the bottom of the barrel by the end of that lockdown.
Like, afterwards, did Wuhan never occur again there? Or do we think it was much bigger there than what was reported?
So China is still holding on to zero COVID policy. So they still treat every single case of COVID with like almost the highest level of alarm. So recently it was reported in the news that a single COVID positive case that visited a Disneyland or was connected in some way to Disneyland resulted in the entire, I think, Shanghai Disneyland being quietly sealed up. 34,000 people in there didn't know they were being sealed up. And then by the end of that evening, all 34,000 of them had been tested for COVID and told to quarantine for 2 days. So they're taking it with such a high level of caution, because they're afraid that if COVID-19 were to get out of control in that country, it would be unstoppable.
Yeah. And also, there's so much of the world supply chain kind of emanates from China. That's the backbone of their economy. It would be a disaster for them. So, what's next? I mean, could there be another virus? What do you think is the most likely outcome in terms of the next virus coming up? Will it be a SARS virus? Will it be some other kind of virus? And how do you think there's enough awareness now we'll be able to deal with it quickly?
So I don't think that we have the data available to accurately predict what the next pandemic will be. I know that a lot of scientists are trying this. And indeed, the entire virus hunting scheme internationally was proposed with the aim of predicting the next pandemic. And they didn't predict the next pandemic. It found us before they predicted it. So you will find, no matter what, you will find hundreds of scientists saying, yeah, we have to watch out for pandemics, we have to watch out for novel emerging pathogens. But they can't tell you which one it's going to be. They can say, yeah, maybe it's an influenza virus, maybe it's like Ebola or Nipah or another SARS or another MERS virus, but no one can look into a crystal ball and tell you what the next pandemic is going to be.
I mean, in your book, it says that Moderna had already come up with a possible vaccine as early as January 13th, 2020. Like, it's basically as soon as they got the genome for COVID, 7 days later, they had a vaccine. And then, of course, it had to go through tests and everything like that. But it sounds like we're getting better and better at these vaccines. Hopefully the testing can get better. And maybe as soon as any kind of outbreak occurs, before it even starts to hit pandemic levels, we could all be immunized against it.
Yeah, I think this pandemic has really taught us that rather than predicting which pathogen is going to come out, we should just work on our surveillance systems. So surveillance at the level of like farms, markets, human like populations, urban populations, just being able to quickly tell when a novel outbreak is starting and send in teams to collect information and to quarantine or seal off the area where there's an outbreak, improving our healthcare systems so that they're not always on the brink of collapsing, improving people's access to vaccines and therapeutics, very important. So there's so many things that we should be investing in preparation for the next pandemic.
And I was going to ask something related to this. I'm just spitting out all of, you're the first person I talked to that could get all the answers. So I'm just spitting out every question I could think of.
I hope I'm answering them correctly.
No,
some
you
of them
are
pretty
you are.
General.
This is really great. This is very valuable to me. So overall, what's your conclusion? I know you tried to be as fair as possible, but maybe you can explain what you think is the likely, you know, history of like where do you think COVID most likely came from? Outside of the context of the book, I know you tried to be fair in the book and steel man your arguments, but what do you think is the most likely?
Everyone wants to know that, right? So people want to have a really detailed answer, have like someone have an expert tell them exactly how it happened. But I can't really give that answer. I really think that we should be focusing on getting those answers though. So I think we should be asking for access to documents describing the kind of research that was happening in Wuhan in the years leading up to the pandemic. Because rather than me or any other expert guessing for you, and people will guess anything. Like there's a whole bunch of people guessing that it was a raccoon dog that brought it up from South China into Central China. So what we need to do really is access this information that actually exists outside of China. It exists here in the US. There's like a whole like mine of information describing the virus research that was happening. For example, in September, documents leaked from the EcoHealth Alliance, an organization that has partnered with the Wuhan Institute of Virology for, I think, a decade, actually, working on this sort of viruses, showing that they were inserting novel genetic features into novel SARS-like viruses. And the kind of experiment described sounds like something that might have generated SARS-CoV-2. So I really hate speculating as a scientist. Like, I want to go get the data. I want to go access the information, particularly when I know it exists and it's within reach.
Well, what's fascinating too is that when you take different cases, let's say from different countries, you could kind of triangulate, almost like GPS. It's almost like a historic, like a timeline GPS, because you could see how many, what level of cousin different viruses are. So how many generations they are from a single ancestor, kind of like a like humans have mitochondrial Eve as like our oldest potential ancestors that we've discovered. So there's sort of a mitochondrial or an initial Eve of COVID. And you could see, like, if I had COVID and you have COVID, you could see how many generations away our different COVIDs are from a single source. And so what do we think is the original, even though November 2019 was the first reported case, what do we think is the actual oldest case based on the different sequences, sequencing of the genome that we have?
So independent groups of scientists have speculated within the frame of September to November. Definitely no later than November 2019. But there are some people who even speculate like summer of 2019. But say that's more on the extreme end of the prediction.
What happened before that? Does that mean until then, bats had it, or pangolins, or whoever? Like, was that the first human version, or what happened before September 2019?
So the prediction is based on all of the existing cases of COVID. So how far back can we say that the parent of all of the existing cases of COVID, when did that parent exist? So prior to that parent, there could have been other SARS-2 precursors, right? But they might have fizzled out. So if they fizzled out, they didn't succeed in transmitting nonstop to other humans, then we wouldn't know of their existence. So this prediction of like September to November 2019 is just the parents of all currently known SARS-CoV-2 sequences.
But before September 2019, does that mean the very first person who had it, does that mean he was hanging out with a bat and the bat gave it to him?
We don't know. And that's the investigation. So was it someone who worked in a lab, or was it someone who was an animal trader, or was it someone who visited a bat cave, whether it was a researcher or an animal trader? So to really find that answer, you have to contact trace the earliest cases, but we have no access to the first cases. Yeah.
And then in the United States, I mean, I don't know when it was theorized. You mentioned in the book, but I forget the date. Like, I don't know when the first cases happened. But one thing I remember looking at was in January of 2020, mm-hmm. flu season had kind of ended in January 2020. But then suddenly New York City hospitals were reporting flu-like cases spiking in the end of January 2020. Does that mean it's quite possible that COVID was already in New York City in late January of 2020, or it could have just been a spike of the flu?
It was probably in New York City by the end of January 2020 already. But the question is, to what extent? So it's like how many cases, right? So I think there it gets more difficult to pinpoint, because it was already spreading in Wuhan City, which is a very well-connected city. You can take a plane from there to almost any country. Then it was certainly spreading to other countries by then. So it's not surprising that you hear of cases, like sporadic cases in America or in Europe by like end of December 2019.
Okay, and then, you know, here we are at the hopefully the tail end of at least this chapter of the story of COVID. What are people worried about with the vaccines? Like, why are people saying, oh, I'll take this vaccine, but not this one, or I'm waiting for this one, or I'll never take one? Like clearly 100 million people or so have taken it in the US, more than that. 160 million people have had the vaccine. There's a lot of evidence that deaths have gone down and hospitalizations have gone down. Yes, you could still be. I saw one paper from Yale where they compared one group of people who have had COVID and another group of people who had the vaccine, and rehospitalization was about 9% on the people who've had COVID within, you know, 6 months, and about 5% among the people who had the vaccine. So it's not perfect, but it seems like it's working. Mm-hmm. To be honest, I haven't really followed all of the news and theories either way, but like, what are people agitated about, and are they right?
Yeah, I have people who won't take the vaccine in my family. So like, it's tough for me. Like, and actually in the beginning of this pandemic, I was also a little bit hesitant to get the vaccine just because it's so new, right? So it's a new technology. There are concerns about whether there would be long-term effects that we don't know about. But so far, nothing has shown up. And it's, again, like, you know, the people who are vaccinated in trials in 2020, nothing bad has happened to them as far as we can tell. So it's a very complicated issue. Some people who don't want to take the vaccine, like they feel like their odds are better if they get COVID than if they get a vaccine. But even against the data, which shows that getting COVID is generally worse than getting the vaccine. So I don't judge them, but I do feel like there should have been better investment in science communication in the way that experts and scientists explain data to people and explain the risk benefits, like the ratio of developing severe outcomes between getting vaccinated versus getting actual COVID-19. So I wouldn't say that their fears are not informed by some rare cases of severe outcomes. So, you know, you hear cases where there's like myocarditis, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, or rare cases where there's allergic reactions to vaccines. But those are largely very rare compared to the severe disease that you can get, especially if you're a bit elderly or if you have underlying conditions.
Right, yeah. I mean, I have not been vaccinated, but not for any conspiracy reason. I'm just lazy. So I sit in my house all day doing podcasts and I'm hardly ever outside, and I didn't get vaccinated. But then when I got COVID, I was like, oh my gosh, I wish I had gotten vaccinated. This is the worst thing that's ever happened to me in my whole life. And it really, I don't want to get it again. Does it make sense to get vaccinated? Like, let's say the day after you have COVID, or how long should you wait after you have COVID before you get vaccinated?
You should definitely wait. It's probably not useful to get it like immediately. I'm not sure what the time frame is. Probably count it in weeks or months. Yeah, and the story you've just told me is true for a lot of people who changed their minds and decided to get vaccinated. It's after someone else in their family or their friends got COVID and developed very severe disease. When you see that personally, you're like, I'm not messing with this. When you see that personally, you're like, yeah, let's vaccinate the entire family because like someone has been in the hospital for 100 days after getting COVID-19. So unfortunately, in some cases, people will only believe it when they see it.
Did you have COVID?
I don't know. We only developed really accessible testing in like mid-2020. Like if you had mild symptoms or something, like you were told not to get tested, right? So I bet there's like thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people who got COVID but don't know.
But you could tell, right? If they test for, I don't know, T cells or antibodies, can you still tell if you've had it?
How many people get tested for that?
but you specifically, I'm surprised you haven't gotten tested for it.
No, I mean, you kind of weigh the benefits of getting tested versus the risk of going to the hospital to get your blood drawn, right? And you don't want to overwhelm the hospital when there's an ongoing pandemic. So a lot of people just let it go, right? Like, just like, okay, I'm fine not knowing. And now that we've all been vaccinated, it's even more difficult to tell. And enough time has passed now that a lot of people got mild COVID, you wouldn't be able to detect.
Well, Dr. Alina Chan, thank you so much for putting up with most of my stupid questions on COVID, some semi-intelligent questions, questions based on the book. The research you did for this book kind of, I should mention, we didn't talk about so many things in the book. Like, you talk about the history of SARS-1, MERS, various flus. You really explain what a virus is, how it goes viral, how they get cured, how it affects the body. And then you go into detailed analysis of all the possibilities of how COVID started, you know, some of which we discussed on this podcast. But it's really just a great book of research about this virus that has caused so much damage in society over the past 2 years. It's remarkable. I feel like I know so much more about it, particularly after talking to you and reading the book. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And I should mention your co-author, Matt Ridley, is also going to come on. And always love having Matt on. He's such a smart guy. Like, what's it like working with Matt Ridley? He's like the smartest guy on the planet.
Yeah, it was really great working with Matt. So I was surprised that he wanted me to co-write this book with him because he's such a well-known writer. So it would have been nothing for him to just write the book by himself. But he reached out to me and he really wanted a like active bench scientist to be involved in this. And I had somehow become a key character in the search for the origin of COVID-19 already. So this book, it really couldn't exist without both of us like putting our heart and soul into it. And I'm really glad to hear that this book was really informative to you.
Like, oh my God, I was so blown away by the book. It was really like, again, COVID's been on everybody's minds every single day, maybe every single minute for the past 2 years. And this is the book on COVID. So I thank you for writing it. And, you know, thanks for answering my questions. And hopefully, you know, every kind of knowledge that is published out there brings us closer to dealing with this and future situations. So thank you again.
Thank you.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.